Welcome to On the Edge with SICK, the podcast where we explore individuals and organizations on the edge of social innovation through a design lens. We're your hosts, Nita and Sylvia, co-founders of SICK.
Hi, everyone. Today on our podcast, we welcome a young blood cancer patient and tireless patient advocate, Tanya Zygomanis. Tanya was diagnosed with multiple myeloma in May 2019 at the age of 37 years old. The diagnosis came out of the blue for Tanya as she had always been in good health. At the time, she was practicing insurance defense litigation at a downtown Toronto law firm, having graduated from Osgoode Hall Law School in 2005. She is married to her longtime best friend, and they have two daughters, aged 11 and 8. Since her diagnosis, Tanya has guided many patients through their own cancer diagnoses, and she has volunteered for a role on Myeloma Canada's Patient Advocacy Council to try and advance the patient voice for this cancer organization. She has proudly raised over $55,000 for myeloma research through various cancer fundraising walks since 2019, and she hopes to raise another $15,000 this year. Welcome, Tanya.
Thank you very much.
So, Tanya, we start with asking all of our guests, what does On the Edge mean to you?
On the Edge means to me on the edge of a cure. So it speaks directly to me in terms of innovation. We're on the edge of curing some cancers, if not most cancers. Innovation's moving so quickly that we're literally on the edge of getting more treatments for patients like me that have incurable illnesses.
That's great. Thanks, Tanya. And we want to start with asking you about your personal journey. So are you able, or can you share with us your personal journey with diagnosis and treatment of myeloma?
Yes, and I'll try to stick to the key points. In early 2019, I was working as a fast-paced litigator in downtown Toronto. I'd been working at the same firm for over 11 years. At the time, I was married. I had a daughter in grade one and a younger daughter in preschool. I'd always been pretty healthy and resilient. I mean, I'd done Orange Theory Fitness the year before and, kind of kept active. But, you know, being a young mom with two kids, life was busy at times and stressful, especially as a litigator. My first warning sign was traveling to Ottawa in February of that year for work. I was lifting some luggage overhead, and days later I had some serious rib pain on my left-hand side that I kind of thought, okay, was like a muscle strain. I had drenching night sweats. I dismissed them as hormonal. I was very fatigued, began to work from home. It was hard to start my day in the morning. By March of that year, I felt like something wasn't right. I was distracted by a nagging feeling. I went to my family doctor's office and I asked for blood work and a chest x-ray. Chest x-ray was normal and my blood work showed I was severely anemic. So a lot of people would say, oh, just take iron, you should be fine. But they had tested some other values and realized that I had really high levels of inflammation. So we had gone on a Disney cruise. We were booked to go towards the end of March. And I remember the day we left, I went back for another blood requisition. And my one of my closest friends, who's a specialist, gave me a super long list of items to test this time, just to cover all my bases in terms of autoimmune illnesses, because cancer was the furthest from our mind. Mm-hmm. So I went on the Disney cruise towards the end of March, and it was our first time as a family, and honestly felt very ill. So I went for more blood work eventually in April, and it revealed some other values, which kind of pointed towards a blood cancer of some sort. I was referred urgently by my family doctor to a hematologist, a local hematologist oncologist. And this is all new to me. I've never really had anyone in my family with cancer, to be honest. So at first, when I saw it was a hematologist, I assumed that I was getting referred for, some sort of a blood illness. but I'd kind of done my own research. I went through each and every one of my values in my blood labs. And being a lawyer, and I do research medical documents to be an insurance defense litigator, it's like part of my daily job. So I kind of had realized that my blood work pointed to being either MGUS, which is the first precursor to multiple myeloma. Okay. And it stands for monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance. So it's like, if you think of myeloma as having a little bit of a value in your blood, it's like a tiny bit of myeloma is showing up in your blood work. The next step is smoldering myeloma, and then there's full-blown multiple myeloma. So I'd never heard of this cancer before. I prayed it was like the precursor, which was MGUS, or some sort of an autoimmune disease. So it was kind of a shock, but I just had a nagging feeling that something wasn't right. Went on to have a bone marrow biopsy at my local hospital. And we'll get to, you know, kind of patient advocacy later, I guess, but just to point out, I had realized later in my journey that most other myeloma patients, especially, you know, that live in urban centers, when they have these symptoms that I had, the bone pain, the fatigue, the night sweats, they're all telltale signs of blood cancers, but they would go straight to their ER and the bone marrow biopsy would essentially be the next day. But because I had a local hematologist at a community hospital, you know, she said, I have to go on vacation and I have other patients. So my bone marrow biopsy actually didn't come for 3 or 4 weeks after my original appointment, where it was quite clear that I might have some sort of cancer. So I tried everything I could to speed that up. And so eventually I had the bone marrow biopsy. It happened to be days before Mother's Day. My hematologist called back and said, you know, you better come in a lot sooner because your results are back. And that's never a good sign when you, when they push up your appointment, which is weeks away to review your bone marrow biopsy. So the bone marrow biopsy came back and said it was full of cancer, full of myeloma. And so I was diagnosed with like 98% in my bone marrow. And it was the day before my oldest daughter's seventh birthday. And the day after I was diagnosed, I had to go to a big family wedding where my little one, who was 4 at the time, was a flower girl. So it was just a really hard weekend process this diagnosis and and to just realize that my life had turned upside down. Odd sense of relief came over me because once a plan was in place with the local hematologist and the local community hospital, I felt like I could shift from like the shock and the pain and the anger to just like fighting. And kind of what a lot of people around me, friends and family, said that they saw, like I just changed into fight mode. I shed very few tears, you know, obviously shed some tears in the beginning, but jumped right into what I could do to kind of battle this cancer. And what I began days after diagnosis was something called Cyborg-D chemotherapy. It's three drugs known as cyclophosphamide, bortezomib, and a very well-known drug. Everyone knows it's a steroid, dexamethasone. Started that at a local community hospital, moved on to a cancer center, which I kind of fought to get into after researching that the community hospitals really have very few patients that have multiple myeloma and very few young patients like myself. So I understood through a lot of research I did online, and my husband also helped me with that, that myeloma patients and really cancer patients do much better when they're with a specialist that has dealt with many patients with that type of specific cancer, obviously, because they have the experience. I dived into treatment, and that was from like May till August of 2019. And what might seem odd is it was like a lovely cancer center, drove kind of through the country to get there. I had friends lining up to take me every week. So I had a very close aunt that decided to take the summer off for me. So she would take me to chemo every week. If not, I had a friend lined up that would take me friends came out of the woodwork kind of to like take mm-hmm. me out for lunch and give a lot of support. To me, my law firm set up something called a care community calendar. So they set that up with coworkers and friends, and they would send us groceries once per week, takeout meals once per week, and they would a couple of times friends would come help with outdoor maintenance. I describe it to many people as a giant hug wrapped around me. It was honestly so nice. Like financially, luckily we worked our butts off as students, my husband and I, and really saved. So we really kept saying, we don't want a GoFundMe. That's like the standard thing. Everyone kind of says, put up a GoFundMe when you have, you know, the need for cancer and you can't work. But mm-hmm. I said, you know, I'm fortunate enough that I don't need that. But despite that, people kind of really came together and gifted us with all of this love that it was amazing. So the month after I was diagnosed, we signed up for a walk at the Princess Margaret Hospital downtown. We raised $10,000, and I quickly realized that I have no control over what happens in terms of my body, in terms of the cancer, but mm-hmm. I can't control what's going on outside. I can control, you know, I can help with research. I can help fund research. And the feeling that I got from that first walk, kind of like my second month into chemo, it was exhilarating. It was, everyone kind of said it was inspiring. Like it really catapulted me into the whole, I'm going to do this. I'm going to have a transplant. Everything's going to be okay. And I have all of this support. 30 people showed up that first day to walk. And then we did a second walk for Myeloma Canada in September, right around the time I was having my stem cell transplant. And mm-hmm. so we had 15,000 then, and I got a plaque from Myeloma Canada for being one of the top fundraisers. And despite the fact that my husband and I had to pull out of that walk because I was quite literally having my transplant the next day, 25 family and friends showed up again. So,
yeah, your story really emphasizes the importance of community care in managing cancer.
And that's something that both was given to me, but I sought out. And so that's kind of what I've told a lot of patients. And I know we'll get to that, but I was really mentored along my journey. So I feel like at some point patients started to reach out to me, and I'm so happy to provide that mentorship going forward, because mm-hmm. I didn't know that this was a thing, but a couple of patient advocates had reached out to me, and they didn't necessarily have my type of cancer at the beginning of my journey, but it really helped to navigate what was about to happen. And, you know, I ended up having to get a wig because I lost my hair. The 4 months of chemo I had prior to my transplant was lower dose, but they blast you with a high dose of chemo during the stem cell transplant I had to have. So I had lost my hair, and, you know, what might seem as a vain experience, you know, losing your hair, what's the big deal? But for a woman who's always had hair and took pride in hair, and mm-hmm. I think it's very difficult because you look in the mirror and that shows you you're sick. Mm-hmm. So I had to get navigated through how to buy a wig, where to buy a wig from. It, you know, obviously something I never thought I'd ever have to deal with, but it was definitely humbling, and it was great because I had a lot of support. I had a lot of people in my corner kind of guiding me through it. So what's key is that I did end up having my stem cell transplant at a top cancer center. So I shifted to a third hospital, and that was also through a lot of advocacy that we did. My husband and I, the day I was diagnosed, like when we had our first consult with the doctor, the Monday after Mother's Day, we actually sent an email out to every single person we knew that, you know, through work, through his work and through my law firm and friends and family, to try and see if we could get into a top cancer center for the transplant, because only top cancer centers will do transplants. But often you have to travel, and that obviously adds to the stress and the cost. And at the time, the Ontario government had kind of like a hold on funding for transplant So there was a hold at the top cancer center, and that's why I actually did not get in until the very last moment. It was very stressful. We really don't know which effort put us in there, but it became clear when speaking to one of my doctors that, you know, advocacy is key, you know, even in the cancer world where people are really suffering with these crazy illnesses. I guess this is key too. A lot of cancer centers do it as inpatient or outpatient. And in order to be outpatient, you have to have like a permanent caregiver that can round the clock administer medication to you. Like I remember, I was outpatient and my husband took 3 weeks off work, and there was a family in the day hospital, they called it, where you would come to be an outpatient there to do your transplant. And this individual who had had the transplant was just really suffering and not well at all. And they advised his family members that they, and the family members agreed, they couldn't take care of this person properly on their own. So he had to be admitted because it really is a grueling process. And my husband had it down to a T. Like the hospital provides you with a chart that basically says, this person needs a medication every 4 hours. Well, this medication needs to be administered every 6 hours or every 8 hours. So, and if you miss that cutoff, the symptoms just really come flooding in. So it was imperative that like we were always on top of the medications. And because I was on so many medications, I think I honestly slept like 14 to 16 hours a day. It's a really long process. You know, a lot of people end up hospitalized with infections, and I was lucky that I didn't have to deal with that.
Wow. Thank you for explaining the complexity of that process. And it's just so interesting that so much burden is placed on the caregiver in that process.
It really is. And my husband felt it, like he had to, you know, get me foods that I could stomach. And, at times, you know, taking my temperature around the clock, because if there was any time that a transplant patient runs even like a temp as low as 38, you have to go to the ER. So it's a stressful process for both of us. And definitely the caregiver has to take a lot of the role on in terms of the emotional stuff. And I still feel fuzzy. You know, chemo brain is a real thing. And I never really understood that until experiencing it myself. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you spoke earlier in your journey about the uncertainty around diagnoses. So how do you think you could better support, like our system could better support patients going through that whole process?
Well, there's one thing Myeloma Canada pairs up with, for example, and a lot of my colleagues have attended this. There's something called family doctor conferences. What we've realized as myeloma patients is that it has to start from the bottom up, and bottom being not that the family doctors are at the bottom, but family doctors are the original source of these patients. Mm-hmm. And a lot of family doctors are coming to us saying, we don't know the signs. We want more education on this. Because a young patient like me, I have a great team of family doctors, and I continue to see them in the original office that I was going to, because it's of no fault of their own. It's very hard to believe a young person gets cancer. Mm-hmm. And it's just a continual struggle, I think, in cancer advocacy, that as a young cancer patient, we're trying to push, you know, get checked earlier. If a patient is telling you they're having some odd symptoms, indulge them. Let them have that diagnostic test. Let them do more blood work, because there's just an unreal amount of stories once you've entered the cancer world, the cancer club, they call it, that nobody wants to be part of, where patients are saying, my symptoms were ignored. Patients end up in ERs and they're still not given the proper testing. And the COVID fallout is that resources are lower. There's less nurses out there because they're quitting and they've just been really burnt out from COVID. Doctors are exhausted and also retiring early. And there's a major burnout from COVID where people are just very tired. And they've dealt with a lot, and COVID has kind of, the fallout's going to be for several years to come, I think. But mm-hmm. I think that's where cancer organizations have to kind of come in, and we're setting up, for example, booths in various hospitals in Ontario to kind of spread the message out, see if patients need support. Just like my experience at the beginning, where I didn't know that in some of the key urban centers, bone marrow biopsies are done very quickly. Like, you are very quickly diagnosed if you are in an urban center, and the statistics show it, versus if you are in the rural part of the country, rural parts of Ontario, and in community centers, community mm-hmm. cancer hospitals or community hospitals that have very tiny chemotherapy units and don't really specialize in cancer. So Myeloma Canada is also kind of, we're focusing on how to improve the patient experience in rural aspects of the country, where people are, they don't know that they should be getting a certain line of therapy next, or the doctors don't know because they don't deal with a lot of, you know, the problem with rural versus urban is in the urban center, you're going to see 100 myeloma patients in a given day at the various hospitals. And at a rural center, you might see one
mm-hmm.
Because it's so desolate. And it's unfortunate where people think in Canada, you're getting amazing medical care. And yes, in many ways, it's awesome. It's great. There's coverage. But there's so many problems with the system that need to be addressed. And being a cancer patient, it's eye-opening. And eye-opening to see, for example, drugs. Drugs is a whole issue. I could probably do a whole podcast mm-hmm. on just drug coverage and access to drugs. As a cancer patient, it's surprising that some of the newer therapies that are coming out, and newer therapies often mean better results, are not covered.
Yeah, it's really shocking to me too, as a provider, fairly new to the cancer system, that there's so many gaps, and our so-called universal healthcare system is nowhere near universal, especially when it comes to pharmaceuticals and coverage of these high cost, potentially life extending, life saving therapies. Yeah, that's a whole other podcast, Tanya.
Yes.
We'll have to
I had one cancer friend that I met at the very first myeloma event 2 weeks into diagnosis. I attended, like, I dived right into the diagnosis, where I was like, I want to go to all the events, all the conferences. I want to, you know, my job is now being a cancer patient and keeping myself the most informed possible. So one of the first people I met had told me that he had fallen down at a golf course. That was his first sign. And that's often the first sign for a myeloma patient. They get a really bad back injury that lands them in the ER.
Mm.
And they, an Ontario hospital had told him he needed to wait. He couldn't get an MRI. He went across the border and paid mm-hmm. out of pocket to get an MRI done. And the MRI revealed the myeloma. So within 2 days. So, and the amount he paid was not exorbitant. Like, I can't remember the exact cost, but it's, yeah, it's just, the journey really exposed to me that you need to really advocate for yourself, even in a universal healthcare system.
Yeah. I mean, that's problematic though, right? Like, I think that it's amazing the stuff that you have done and other advocates have done, but do they have to? Like, should everyone be expected to be an advocate for their care when they're going through a really difficult, complex illness? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, exactly. Like, I assumed, you know, once you're diagnosed with cancer, you're kind of treated, you know, well by everyone. And I assumed being a 37-year-old cancer patient. Like, that's kind of where I was at my first week of diagnosis. How mm-hmm. am I not with the top specialists in the country? And I know this might sound narcissistic, but when you get such a shocking diagnosis at the age of 37 and are told people in their 70s get this type of cancer, and it's a terminal cancer and it's incurable. Mm-hmm. You think, I it's free healthcare in Canada. So I want to be with the top person. I have a rare cancer and I'm a rare patient to have this cancer. But it doesn't work like that. And, you know, it was shocking to me to realize that, luckily, you know, we've kind of learned through this whole process to advise patients that even if you're at a community hospital, seek out a second opinion. And usually the top cancer hospitals in Canada will be willing to provide a second opinion. They'll even give you an appointment. So that's something patients don't often know. I mean, we have Facebook groups set up for Myeloma Canada, and we're always kind of jumping on there and helping the patients out. And all the patients kind of help us, community members on that group, to kind of advise new patients, and not just new patients. Like, you know, there's a question sometimes that I'll have coming up. I had a bone density scan last week and I hadn't had one in several years. So I had a couple of questions, for patients on there. And, we're really advising patients, how to push for themselves and advocate for themselves, get the scans. And patients are kind of learning through like social media how to advocate in many ways. Myeloma Canada also pairs together with a conference that happens every year called Health E-Matters. So this is an emerging field, I guess, for, you know, and it's part of innovation too, where social media is being used now as a way to push patient advocacy. And people setting up blogs and Instagram accounts being public to document their cancer journey and to not only do that, but kind of advise new cancer patients how to navigate the system and how to push for themselves and advocate for themselves and, you know, call back and get the test done sooner, try and get on a cancellation list, because delays are a real thing in the cancer world. You think that they would prioritize cancer patients, but it's not always the case. It's actually very rarely the case. So that was something that was kind of eye-opening, but you quickly learn that you have to be pushy. And it's unfortunate that you have to do that as a cancer patient. But I think you have to do that as any patient these days.
Yeah, you're probably right. And it speaks to our whole take on healthcare and keeping it sort of industrial and process focused, and just even the term patient advocate. Like, is that the most appropriate term? Like, do we need to put these roles onto patients? I mean, for yourself, you have a lot of resources and a lot of advantage over some other patients out there in terms of like your younger age, your law background, your family support. And a lot of cancer patients don't have those things and can't necessarily advocate for themselves. So I like that you mentioned the provider education piece, because I think that's really important, and connecting rural providers with more specialist providers and some sort of maybe e-referral process that I've heard of before, so that they can talk to those specialists and if they have questions and kind of help them through a tricky diagnosis.
Yes. Yes. And patients often don't necessarily need to be at a cancer center or like the top hospital for this type of cancer. They just want to hear that what care they're receiving is the care they would have been receiving at the top cancer hospital. Mm. And, Ontario should be streamlined. There's something called Cancer Care Ontario where, and most provinces should be like this, where you're getting the same care. It doesn't matter whether you're at a community hospital or at the cancer center, you should be getting the same types of treatment as all the other patients. So I think this is a way of also introducing accountability, because some of these doctors may not, may not realize that there's different ways of treating a patient. And myeloma patients have a lot of comorbidities. Mm-hmm. So that's something that complicates things even further, like kidney issues and heart issues, and especially just by virtue of some of these patients being over 70. And that's a whole other thing too. You had mentioned, me being a young patient, definitely I have the energy for the walks. I have the know-all versus a lot of the other patients about social media and internet, mm-hmm. and where they weren't kind of raised on this, but we kind of find there's a lot of volunteer opportunities. And I find it interesting. I commiserate a little bit with some of the other young cancer moms or family, young cancer families, where some of the other patients that have grown children have a lot of time for cancer advocacy. Mm-hmm. So finding the time has been hard, but just the feeling that you get from, again, I think I said it before, I don't have a lot of control over this illness, but it helps you feel like you have a purpose and that you're doing something for your illness, where you get the opportunity to advocate and raise funds towards the research.
Thank you so much, Tanya. What's one key takeaway or learning that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
One thing I tell everyone when they're diagnosed is, as much as you feel like you want to hold it in and keep it private, the most support you're going to get and the most resources you're going to get is to be open. Because fortunately we are in a very digital age, and we have to actually, be happy about that in terms of, progressing things for cancer, where that's how, I was able to connect with many long-term patients, with the Myeloma Canada organization. Just being really open about my illness, I had about 10 people come out of the woodwork, and people that connected me with the cancer center that I ended up with. That's how I ended up there. I didn't even realize that there were myeloma specialists at this other cancer center that I was doing my chemotherapy at. So just kind of being open to being open about your illness and seeking out the help that way, that kind of really helped me build into this patient advocacy role and to kind of push your agenda forward, because cancer is a growing problem. Unfortunately, the statistics used to be that it was 40% of us will get cancer. Now we're heading towards 50%, mm-hmm. and they're expecting that to grow. So every one of us will at some point know someone who's had cancer in their lifetime, or unfortunately have it ourselves. And we can only just hope that with more advocacy, we can get early diagnoses done and more treatments through research and pushing the agenda of these organizations forward, these cancer research organizations. So,
Tanya, how can our listeners connect with you?
Well, I can be reached by email. It's tzigomanis, so tzigomanis @gmail.com. And I also run a support group in the York region for myeloma patients. Each region has a myeloma support group. So it's called the York Region Support Group, and it's yorkregionsupport@myeloma.ca. And the Myeloma Canada website, I'm listed on there as well, has a ton of resources. If anyone's curious to read up on myeloma or ever wants to support the organization, we have a number of walks we're going to be doing in September, and I'm really excited because a lot of the walks were put on hold during COVID and they were done virtually. So we're going to be kind of getting back into in-person stuff in terms of myeloma marches.
Awesome. Thank you so much. We'll have all those resources in our show notes.
Thank you for listening to On the Edge with your hosts, Nita and Sylvia. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others or drop a comment and rating. head over to sickhealth.ca to learn more about Sick and check out all the links and resources in the episode show notes. Thanks, and stay tuned for future podcast episodes with On the Edge with Sick.